From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Actor Randy Quaid wanted to be the only Quaid in Hollywood. When his brother Dennis became an actor, Randy's first reaction was to ask his brother to change his last name. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Randy Quaid talks about working with his brother and about his own changing image in movies and television. Also today, film historian Ron Haver talks about his quest to restore the 1954 Hollywood classic A Star Is Born. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers the days when rock and roll radio was a total lifestyle, commercials and all. And book critic John Leonard reviews Dictionary of the Khazars. It's a new novel from Yugoslavian writer Milorad Pavic about a mysterious medieval culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Actors Randy Quaid and Dennis Quaid are brothers whose careers have taken them in different directions. Dennis, with his athletic good looks, usually gets the leading man roles. The 6'4" Randy, with his slightly jowly cheeks and large facial features, has been playing character roles. They acted together in the film The Long Riders and in the off-Broadway play True West. And next year, Randy will direct himself and Dennis in the film Power of the Dog. Randy Quaid is best known to film audiences for his roles in the last picture show Fool for Love, The Last Detail, and National Lampoon's Vacation. On TV, he portrayed Lyndon Johnson in the miniseries LBJ The Early Years, and he was a regular on the 1985-86 season of Saturday Night Live. We'll be seeing a lot more of Randy Quaid in the next few months. In the forthcoming films Bloodhounds of Broadway, Out Cold, and Parents, he co-stars respectively with Madonna, Terry Garr, and Mary Beth Hurt. He plays a golf pro in the HBO movie Dead Solid Perfect, which premieres on December 18th. Some of these are starring roles and different kinds of characters than Quaid was offered when he first began his film career.
When I first started acting, I was given a lot of parts that were such like country bumpkins, the rube, the naive characters, the hero's best friend, and these parts were fine, you know, for the time being. But I always felt like I had more in me to contribute as an actor, and for the last few years, I've been getting the kind of parts that I find intriguing and challenging.
You said that for years you were offered the country bumpkin type of part. What do you think it was that got you cast in those kinds of roles, being from the South, being very tall and broad?
I think, there's a combination of that. I'm originally from Houston, and when I first came out to California, I had a really thick Texas accent, and that immediately categorized me as a country-flavored actor. And so I think it's been a long process, you know, to get past that and those types of roles. And I worked on my voice a little bit, not consciously, but I just think being...
You mean losing an accent?
Yeah, being away from Texas, I tended to gradually lose the accent.
What's the most refreshing role of your new movies coming out, the most refreshing for you to have done?
I would say it's Parents. It's a movie for Vestron that Bob Balaban directed and Mary Beth Hurt, and I played these parents. And it's a dark comedy, a psychological horror picture that deals with parent-child relationships, basically, and the parents have a deep, dark secret that I won't go into right now, but that's basically what the movie's about. And it's the type of picture that you will be laughing, and then they'll turn around and you'll be scared in the next moment, hopefully.
You and your brother, Dennis Quaid, are an interesting comparison in the sense that you get a lot of character roles and he gets a lot of leading man-type roles.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose in a way that's been very good in the sense that you don't compete for the same roles, whereas some brothers and sisters do compete for the same roles.
Yeah, it's Dennis and I are definitely, I think, different types. Our careers have gone in different directions. He's more of the traditional leading man, and I'm more of what you might call a character actor. And I personally prefer the parts that I've been getting, you know, recently, because they're I don't play the same type of role with each movie.
Well, there seems to be more idiosyncrasy in the world of character actors than in the world of leading men, and sometimes it's the character actors who bring a lot of the energy to a movie, a lot of the idiosyncrasy.
Yeah, they really are the color, I suppose, that carry the movie along. The hero really is the driving force of the picture, and the character parts really add the nuances and the color along the way that the hero reacts off of.
Actor Randy Quaid is my guest. You're going to be directing a movie called Power of the Dog, in which you and your brother Dennis both star. Would you describe what each of your roles will be in the movie?
Well, the parts, they're set in 1925 in Montana on a ranch, and we would play brothers who are in their middle to late 30s, and they've grown up on this ranch together their whole lives. They even sleep in the same room together. And one of the brothers, my character, decides that he wants to get married, and the main conflict of the movie deals with my character bringing my wife and her 15-year-old kid home to live on this ranch, and the other brother's resentment to their presence.
What's the experience like to direct your brother?
Well, I don't know yet. I've never done it, but I'm looking forward to it. I feel that Dennis has really developed into a really good actor, especially with this new picture of his, Everybody's All American. I was really impressed with what he did with that role, and I think that because I know him better than anyone, really, that I can find things with this character that he's going to play that will really show him in a different light that hasn't been achieved before.
You worked with your brother on the film Long Riders, which was a movie that starred a lot of different brothers. It was about the Jesse James and Cole Younger gangs, and it starred Robert Keith and David Carradine, Stacy and James Keach, and you and Dennis Quaid. It was produced by the Keach brothers. I was wondering if you took time out to talk with all the other brothers in the movie about what it's like to be in the profession with a brother who acts.
Well, we didn't. We never really sat down and had a discussion about that. Hollywood has always been a town of nepotism, and it's a comforting thing, really, at times to work with your brother. It's you know, you go to work, and there's part of your family there. It gives you a real sense of familiarity, I love working with my brother. We did a play called True West by Sam Shepard for about 6 months a few years ago, and it was a very therapeutic experience for Dennis and I, and we came away from the play much closer than we had been going in, and I liked that experience a great deal.
In the play True West, the brothers fight a lot. Were you able to use sibling rivalry within your relationship and bring that out?
Oh, yeah.
On stage?
Mm-hmm. When we were growing up, I always tried to make Dennis mad. You know, I was always, we're always fighting, and I think I was just trying to get my mother's attention more than anything, because when Dennis came along, he sort of took all the focus between the two of us, and so I spent the rest of my childhood trying to get it back, you know, to my side of the family, and I would incorporate this during a play, you know, to do things to upset Dennis, which was within the characters that we were playing, because my character was always doing things to upset the other brother. So I would, whisper things to Dennis like, why don't you do more with this moment here, you know, during the performances, and giving him stage directions, and and it would upset him, you know. But it really worked for the play.
Gee, are you going to bring out this facet of your relationship when you're directing him?
Well,
I'm sure, he's really going to love it.
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of thing you know. You have to be careful when you play upon those kind of moments.
Well, sure. I mean, you can really inflame somebody's anger and have that live forever, even though you just meant to bring out a certain emotion in a scene that you were doing.
Yeah, I remember we quit. We took a hiatus from True West for about 3 or 4 months, and then came back to it. And there's a few moments in the play where I slap Dennis on the back of the head with the palm of my hand, just a kind of a brotherly gesture that we had growing up. And the first time we did this in rehearsal, when we came back to doing the play, it really upset Dennis. He had to leave the rehearsal room and go outside, and we had a nice long talk about resuming the play and some of the feelings that we had in our childhood and bringing that back to life on the stage. And I think it was just a reaction from some sort of deep recess in Dennis's psyche that allowed him to react as he did when I would hit him on the back of the head. And it was a reaction to how he was treated as a child by me, and I really felt a lot of compassion for him for the first time. I love Dennis very much, and I would never do anything to hurt him, and I didn't realize that all these years I'd been really having this kind of effect on him.
Hmm. When you got to Hollywood before he did.
Yeah.
What was your first reaction when you knew that he was going to act, and in fact he'd be coming out to Hollywood too? Was it one of rivalrous feelings, or of glad feelings knowing that you'd have company coming?
Well, at first it was it was kind of a combination of both of those feelings. It was a bit rivalrous, I would say, in the beginning. I had felt that I had made a name for myself out there. I'd been nominated for an Academy Award, and I essentially wanted to be the only Quaid in the business, you know. And I asked my brother if he had changed his name, and he said, no, I like my name, and it's my name, and, I understood. But it
well, he must have loved that.
Yeah. and he says that I never helped him get in the business. You know, I introduced him to my agents and told him some people to go talk to, but Dennis really did it more or less on his own.
You said you wanted to be the only Quaid. Did a casting director ever call the wrong brother accidentally?
No, that's not happened. No. And it's worked out just fine, really, for the both of us.
Mm-hmm. What made you want to act?
I went into acting originally because the drama room was air conditioned in high school, and
and you lived in Texas, so
yeah,
that was more of a benefit than it might seem to us Northerners.
Yeah, it was very humid there, and but I originally started out doing impressions, and I remember a high school talent show that I got up the nerve to audition for and got on that, and went out on stage, and the first time I heard the laughs, I knew that's what I wanted to do. It was like a big wave of love coming over the footlights there, and it really turned me on.
Who were you doing impressions of?
Well, back then, this was like in 67 something, Jimmy Stewart, James Cagney, Lyndon Johnson I used to do then, pretty much the standard people.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned you used to do impressions of Lyndon Johnson, because you actually played Lyndon Johnson in the made-for-TV movie, LBJ, the early years. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember on Saturday Night Live you doing Johnson, too?
No, I never did him on Saturday Night. I did Reagan.
Right, no, I know. Yeah. I remember, yeah, and Terry Sweeney would be Nancy.
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh. Opposite you. Uh-huh. Well, what's the difference between doing a president in a character comedy sketch, you know, doing an impression of LBJ, and doing him in a movie in a serious role? Were you able to use any of the traits you picked up in your comic impersonation?
No, the impression I did was very exaggerated and more buffoonish than the way I portrayed him in the movie. When you're doing a role, you have to you have to bring a lot of yourself to it, and that's essentially what I did. But if you're doing an impression, it's more of a sketch type of exaggeration.
In the voice as well?
In the voice as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your acting career and about some of the movies that you've been in. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is actor Randy Quaid, and he played Lyndon Johnson in the TV miniseries LBJ The Early Years and was a series regular on Saturday Night Live during the 85-86 season. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his role in The Last Detail. He starred along with his brother Dennis in the film The Long Riders and in the off-Broadway production of True West. Quaid has three new films scheduled to open early next year, and he plays a golf pro in the HBO special Dead Solid Perfect, which debuts on December 18th. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Randy Quaid is my guest. Your very first movie was Paper Moon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were still in college.
Well, my first picture actually was The Last Picture Show.
That's but what I mean.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That is what I mean.
it was a pretty small role. You want to describe the role?
Well, his character was called Lester Marlowe, and he was basically the rich kid in this small town in Texas. And he tried to win Sybil Shepherd's character from the character that Jeff Bridges played, and ends up taking her to this nude swimming party. And he was more or less a real rakish, kind of a goofy-looking guy. And I couldn't believe the reaction to the character that when they started screening the film. I was still in school in Houston, and one Saturday afternoon, I remember I got a call from Peter Bogdanovich. He wanted me on a plane the next day to come out to Hollywood and do What's Up, Doc? With Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill, and that was like a dream come true. I mean,
what kind of reaction were you getting?
Well, people were, when he called me, he told me they really love your part, and you know, he mentioned people like Groucho Marx or what they'd said to him, and I mean, I was just flabbergasted, I thought, well, maybe I could have a career doing this. I thought Last Picture Show was going to be like a drive-in picture, I really didn't give it much thought after I finished it. I was just planning to go back to school and decide what I wanted to do, you know, go to New York or Hollywood or something after I finished school.
Did you go back to school after you got these offers to do more films?
No, I didn't. Briefly I did, but you know, for a couple of weeks. But then I got another call and had to come back out to California to do I think I got cast in a TV movie. And things just started taking off really right after Picture Show came out.
Do you remember the very first audition that you had to do for a movie?
Well, that was, let's see, probably for Brewster McCloud. Robert Altman was in town casting it, and well, that was more or less a meeting. I guess the first reading audition was for Last Picture Show, and I went in thinking, well, Dustin Hoffman, he's He's about the hottest actor around right now. I'll just like do an impression of Dustin Hoffman.
Is that what you did?
Yeah. And and Bogdanovich was in this other room with a camera, and he had me read a scene from the script, and I had this kind of smirk on my face, kind of like Dustin has at times, and I guess he liked that for the part. I ended up getting cast in Last Picture Show in a different part than I read for him.
So if you were imagining Dustin Hoffman, if you were doing an impression of him, what role were you doing an impression of him in?
The Graduate.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. do you still have to audition for roles, or are you just called and offered certain roles?
Well, most roles, they just send me the script and make an offer. There's some roles that I have to audition for. I recently auditioned to play an Italian mafiosa type of character, and which is, you know, I don't look Italian per se, but they were very impressed with the reading, apparently. I don't know if I'm going to do that role or not, but yeah, so certain roles, if you're not specifically right for it, if I feel like I have to prove to them that I can do a role, I'm very willing to audition. I had a screen test for Lyndon Johnson, I remember, and it so happened that the head makeup man at NBC was Lyndon Johnson's makeup man when he was in the White House, so he did my makeup for the screen test, and I went in there and they did all, they turned me around and a lot of times and had me read from books and scenes and everything. And it was about a 3-hour ordeal, but I ended up getting the role.
Did you do any comic impressions for the makeup man?
No.
You might have really appreciated it.
I wanted to, at the time, you know, I wanted to put all that behind me.
Right.
And just concentrate on the character.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the last detail, you got an Academy Award nomination for that. You played someone who was sentenced for 8 years for attempting to steal $40, and so you were in the military. You were being escorted to the brig. One of the characters escorting you was played by Jack Nicholson. I always read a lot about the difficulty of holding the camera, of holding people's attention on screen when you're playing against someone who's very, very intense. And Nicholson certainly has that kind of intensity on screen. Now, he was playing somebody who was very focused, very, very kind of conniving and streetwise. You were playing someone who was not really bright, who was terminally depressed, very insecure. Yet you really held the screen opposite him. It seemed like it would have been a hard role to do that because you weren't playing a quote, magnetic character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the opposition of those two characters allowed for each character to come through. And Jack is a very generous actor. He really gave me a lot.
What does that mean?
Well, he allows you to have your moments as an actor. He doesn't try to steal the scene. He doesn't have an ego like that, like a lot of actors do. And you see that in his performances. Terms of Endearment, you know, he allows himself to be seen as this fat, you know, aging astronaut. I mean, he's probably my favorite modern actor. He and I had developed a wonderful relationship during the film, and I'll never forget him for what he gave and allowed me to do in that picture.
Mm-hmm. So you learned a lot making that movie.
Yeah, I mean, everybody was concerned, well, here's Jack and here's this 6'4" gangly actor who's going to tower above him. But Jack said, no, that's great. Let's go with him. And, you know, the difference in size really, really helped a lot, too.
Well, you held your head at an angle during a lot of that movie.
Yeah.
Almost as if it was too heavy to hold up.
Yeah, well, the character was like that. He was real downcast and really withdrawn inside himself. And I wanted to give the impression that I was almost hiding inside my pea coat. And you know, hence that the head droop.
Actor Randy Quaid is my guest. You did Saturday Night Live for the 85-86 season. Mm. Most of the people on Saturday Night Live are comics who end up with acting careers after they leave the show. For you, you'd already had an acting career, and then you were coming on Saturday Night Live. It was really like the reverse order for what's traditionally done there. What did you want out of Saturday Night Live?
I wanted to get back into comedy, because I started out, like I said earlier, doing stand-up impressions and nightclub acts, and I just wanted to be around comedy, and I wanted to be offered more comedic scripts. And I felt that it was kind of a chancy thing to do at the time, to go from being an actor to doing sketch comedy on television, but I wanted to experience the live television format and see a lot of comedians and work on comedy and how to achieve laughs and what's funny basically it paid off. I've been doing a lot of comedies the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was known as, like, the worst year for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, yeah.
did that ever get to you? Because it was the year when all the critics were writing, actually, they'd been writing this for a couple of years already, that, oh, is this the end of Saturday Night Live? It just got such bad reviews. It must have been kind of demoralizing.
Well, it was. After a while, it did begin to wear on me, all the negativity. I think I might have gone on and done another year if... there had been a really universally positive response to the show, but I got out of it what I wanted to get. I think there was a lot of anticipation with Lorne Michaels coming back after 5 years, the original producer of the show, coming back as a producer, and I think people had their expectations set too high. I think a lot of the writing could have been funnier. I was a little disappointed by the year as a whole, but like I said, overall, I think it was a positive experience for me personally.
You know, I'm thinking that with your three or four new movies coming out and the movie you're about to direct with your brother Dennis Quaid, and Dennis Quaid starring in a new movie now and about to make the Jerry Lee Lewis movie, that your careers are both really rising simultaneously, which must be really good for you both. Because it could have been the kind of thing where one of you was really resenting the other.
Yeah, I that could have happened, I suppose. But it's a good thing. I think it helped that I had a little something going before Dennis got there, and I was really really happy for Dennis to see him achieve his success as well. And I think we're both really developing into what we set out to achieve. And it was. You know, tough. We got a lot of, or I did when I first wanted to be an actor, a lot of a barrier was thrown up by my father and mother, and they wanted me to more or less pursue a traditional kind of career. But this is something that I wanted to do, and since then my father got into acting, and now my stepbrother's into acting.
I mean, really?
The whole family's jumped on.
Trying to be the Carradine family.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been actor Randy Quaid, and he stars in an HBO movie called Dead Solid Perfect, which debuts on December 18th. He has three new films scheduled to open in the next few months: Out Cold with Terry Garr and John Lithgow, Bloodhounds of Broadway with Madonna, and Parents. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Gore Vidal. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ron Haver was only 16 years old the first time he saw the 1954 version of the movie A Star Is Born, but he knew something was missing. It's taken him three decades to track down many of the scenes originally cut from the film. Coming up, Ron Haver talks about his successful quest to restore a Hollywood classic. Remember when rock radio was more yakking and less smooth talk? Rock historian Ed Ward has some thoughts on how the role and sound of commercial rock and roll radio has changed. And book critic John Leonard reviews Dictionary of the Khazars by Milorad Pavic. It's a new novel in dictionary form that both unearths and invents the mysteries of an ancient tribe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President-elect Bush said today he's asked Nicholas Brady to stay on as Treasury Secretary in the new administration. In making the expected nomination of his friend and advisor, Bush praised Brady for his extraordinary knowledge of financial markets and his experience in the private sector. The nomination was seen as a signal to world markets that Bush does not anticipate any sharp deviations from the economic policies of President Reagan. The U.S. government has reacted cautiously to the declaration of a Palestinian state and the Palestine Liberation Organization's acceptance of a UN resolution recognizing Israel's right to exist. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The State Department promised to give the PNC declarations, quote, serious study when final texts become available, apparently seeing more substance in them than the Israeli government does. But both Israel and the U.S. have rejected the PLO's declaration of an independent Palestinian state in the occupied territories. State Department spokesman Charles Redman.
The status of the West Bank and Gaza cannot be determined by unilateral acts of either side, but only through a process of negotiations.
U.S. officials were mildly encouraged today that the PLO has apparently accepted U.N. resolutions 242 and 338, which recognize Israel's right to exist and provide the basis for Arab-Israeli peace. In the past, PLO officials have sometimes said they accept the two resolutions, along with all other relevant U.N. resolutions, some of which contradict the spirit of 242 and 338. The U.S. wants the PLO to drop that ambiguity. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, Arabs held celebrations to mark the declaration of an independent Palestinian state. But as NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Jerusalem, Israeli security forces staged a crackdown at the same time the Palestinians celebrated.
The occupied territories were almost completely sealed off from journalists today. The West Bank was mostly under curfew, the widest such curfew in 21 years of Israeli occupation. And the entire Gaza Strip was under curfew for an unprecedented fourth day. The restrictions appear to have prevented violence, although thousands of residents of the Gaza Strip defied the curfew and went into the streets last night to let off fireworks and chant nationalist slogans about an independent Palestinian state. Soldiers chased the demonstrators away, but there were few major confrontations. Despite warnings of long prison terms and stiff fines for celebrating, there were no reports of Israeli arrests today. In the refugee camps of the Gaza Strip, there were disturbances resulting in injuries and at least two deaths, according to Israel Radio. Palestinians said today was a day to put aside the violence of the 11-month Palestinian uprising and to think about the future. For now, the future of the occupied territories is indefinite Israeli restrictions and an Israeli government categorically opposed to any Palestinian state. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev today confirmed news that he plans to visit the U.S. for an address at the United Nations in early December. The visit would be part of a tour to Cuba and Great Britain, intended to emphasize international relations and world security. The White House welcomed news of the visit, but President Reagan emphasized that while he would meet in New York with the Soviet leader, the meeting should not be construed as a summit. It's expected that President-elect Bush will participate in any superpower meetings at the U.N. The first Soviet space shuttle got off the ground and returned to Earth today in a flight Soviet officials hailed as a major success. The unmanned shuttle, called Buran, blasted into orbit early this morning, orbited the Earth twice, and glided to a remote-controlled touchdown on a landing strip just a few miles from the launch pad. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 12.09, finishing at 2077.11 in light trading. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're about to hear the one thing you virtually never get to hear on public radio, commercials. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has found a collection of some memorable ads from commercial rock radio.
I guess one thing most of us old folks agree on is that rock and roll radio isn't what it used to be. Today, you can hear any one of several rock and roll formats, each of which is shaped by what the radio industry calls research, and each of which is tailored to one or another specific segment of the listening population. In one way, this is a good deal. It could be argued that as a result, more music gets exposed. But the truth of the matter is, there's a degree of innocence missing in contemporary radio, and that's a shame. When there was only one kind of rock and roll radio, it was run by people who really didn't know what they were doing, and staffed by people who not only knew, but loved it. Rock and roll radio was an important lifeline to the teenage community. It kept you informed, not only with its puny news broadcasts, but with its commercials. You could learn about important sports events, for instance.
Tomorrow, Saturday night at 8:30 and Sunday at 2 p.m., all of the country's Jet, Rocket, and Turbine cars together at one time. 13 spectacular flight-throwing monsters.
The famous 10,000 horsepower Unpushable.
Arfon's incredible Green Monster.
Dynamic Reactions X1 Rocket.
The Mighty Liquidator.
Chuck Suba's US-1.
The Jet Charger Dodge.
Arfon Superjet Exodus.
The Jet Comet Cyclone.
And Palamedes' new Jet Cougar Hypersonic.
Plus the wild Turbine Dart.
The Turbine Mustang Pegasus.
And the fiery Turbine Power Dragster Psychedelic.
Then Monday, Labor Day,
the UDRA Fuel Funny Car Circuit.
16 mile funny cars.
You could get sage advice.
Hi, this is Sonny.
And this is Cher. You know, school starts again on Monday, September the 13th.
That's right. And I've got one good reason all the guys should go back to school.
You mean besides an education being the only way to really make it today?
Sure, school is where it's really at.
Take it from us.
Stay cool. Go back to school.
But the most important thing rock and roll radio did was to make certain its listeners knew where to connect with each other. Even when a station didn't play records by a given act, in most parts of the country, any rock and roll show was worthy of mention just because it was there. Sure, some of the shows advertised were pretty lousy.
KFRC presents The Monkees. The Monkees have chosen San Francisco for their first personal appearance in California. 3 p.m. Sunday, January 22nd. You're in for the most spectacular stage show ever presented by a young group. Tickets are $3, $4, $5, and $6. Available only by...
Others were the things of legend.
Pop goes Andy Warhol's Plastic Inevitable show at the Trip starting tonight. You'll flip at the Velvet Underground and Nico, the Incredible Light Show, and Andy's fabulous underground movies better not miss it.
Does anybody out there recognize that DJ? He sure sounds familiar, even though he seemed to think that Nico was the light show instead of the singer. Of course, in a place like Los Angeles, where the Trip was located, you'd get some really spectacular shows. Check out this package.
Oh, the Yardbirds of Governor Catalina. It's the only L.A. appearance I had is with a Moonlight Cruise at the Casino Ballroom on Catalina Island. It's your chance to see and dance with this fantastic group from England. The Yardbirds, no age limit, return the same night. Admission to the dance plus the cruise, all for only $10. For information...
A boat ride to and from Santa Catalina Island, plus the Yardbirds with Jimmy Page, if my dating of this ad is right, all for only $10? Maybe not all teenagers could afford that, but imagine if you could. Another thing about the concerts, then, was the lineups you'd get to see.
22nd Century Productions proudly presents The Doors.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe. Can you leave?
Yes, The Doors are off in touring, and Saturday, June 14th, they arrive at the Auditorium Theater in Chicago for two big shows. The Doors filling the auditorium with sound and love.
Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name?
You'll be filled with good vibrations Saturday, June 14th at the Auditorium Theater. The Doors with the Staple Singers, that gregarious gospel group that will have you clapping your hands and stomping your feet. When The Doors and the Staple Singers get together, you never know what's going to happen next, except good entertainment.
I wonder what booking agent dreamed that combination up. Of course, not all of the information you got on these ads was perfectly honest either. See if you can decode this.
The heavy drums of Ginger Baker, plus the wailing guitar of Eric Clapton. It's the concert spectacular of the year as the Boss Jocks present The New Cream.
I've been waiting so long to be where I'm going in the sunshine of your love.
The New Cream, Blind Faith at the Spectrum July 16th at 8 p.m. Steve Winwood of Traffic brings voice and organ at the bass of Rick Gresh, plus Ginger Baker and Eric Clapton making rock history
in the white room.
Somebody'd get sued for that these days. At long last, though, it began to hit home that the rock and roll audience had a lot of money. It was young, vast, and spent an amazing amount on clothes, cars, and records. Just as today, when songs are ruined by being used in ads, back then, the fall from innocence began when rock and roll's secret language hit Madison Avenue. Here's a classic.
All right, all you lepidopterists, get out your steel nets and let's go catch the iron butterfly.
Man won't wear off as the day wears on. Man won't wear off as the day wears on. Man, get you through the longest day. Man has the stuff to stay and stay. Man won't wear off as the day wears on.
Turn on Band Spray Deodorant. It doesn't turn off, even after you turn in.
I just don't feel the same way about the Iron Butterfly after that. These ads came off of a weird record I found in Germany, and I guess in the end what I like about them is that they remind me that rock and roll radio was a total experience, and that the noise people made between the records was, in its own way, as much a part of the rock and roll experience as the records themselves. To tell the truth, they still are. They're just not as crude as these relics of 1967.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air.
The night is bitter, the stars have lost their glitter, the winds grow colder, suddenly you're older, and all because of the man that got away.
The 1954 version of A Star is Born starred Judy Garland as movie star Vicki Lester and James Mason as her husband, the has-been actor Norman Maine. Its opening was a much-anticipated Hollywood event. It was director George Cukor's first musical. It had songs by Harold Arlen and Ira Gershwin, and it marked Garland's movie comeback after a four-year hiatus. But shortly after it was released, 25 minutes were deleted from the film to shorten its three-hour length. Since 1983, moviegoers have been able to see a more complete version of the film. It was restored by Ronald Haver, the head of the film department at the Los Angeles County Museum. His new book, A Star is Born, tells a dual story, the making of the 1954 version and the detective work that went into his 1983 restoration. Haver first saw the film as a teenager, and it was one of his primal moviegoing experiences.
The thing about A Star is Born was that it was so beautiful to look at, first of all. It had a palpable impact visually and orally, because it was in stereophonic sound, which was very new at the time. Also, I'd never seen Judy Garland before. I think I'd seen her in The Wizard of Oz, and that was a disappointment because they strayed so far from the book. But I had never seen her. I'd never really been exposed to her personality or her singing, which was phenomenal. And James Mason. Now, James Mason seemed to embody everything that I would wanted to have been if I were an adult. And then, of course, it was about Hollywood, which is I was very enamored of Hollywood, and the fact of it looking so beautiful, and they used so many locations around the area. It was a very seductive movie. That's the one thing I can remember about it, was that I just wanted to see it over and over again, to hear it and to look at it.
How did you become aware of the fact that there were production numbers that were deleted, that excerpts of scenes were deleted?
Well, there used to be, back in the 50s, a magazine, a movie magazine, called Screen Stories. And every month they would publish what they would call fictionalizations of the new movies that were being released. I was, as I said, caught up by Hollywood, so I began reading this Starsborn thing, and there it was, and I thought, well, this is interesting, I'll go see it. So when it finally came to my neighborhood theater, all the stuff that they had described, all the scenes that they had described in the beginning were no longer there. Also, in the those days, they used to put stills in the front of the theaters. There were several scenes in the stills that were not in the film at all, and they had played the soundtrack album ad nauseum on the radio, and two of the songs were not in the film that were on the album. So I thought, well, there must be more to this. And of course, while you were watching it, some parts of it made no sense at all in terms of continuity. People disappeared, lines made no sense because they referred to things that didn't, that weren't in the film anymore. So I began at that point, I think almost within a couple of weeks after I'd seen the film, trying to find the full-length version, trying to see it anyway, and I never did. I never did see it.
Now you know why some of that footage was cut out. Maybe you can tell us a little bit of that story.
Well, when the picture opened, it was 3 hours and 1 minute. It was a very long movie for 1954. So the exhibitors kept yelling to and complaining to Warner Brothers, the people that made it, that if it were shorter, they could get in more shows and they could make more money. So Warner Brothers bowed to the inevitable and just took big chunks out of it, 25 minutes. And instead of doing it in an intelligent, dramatic manner, they just lifted out whole reels and musical numbers. So when you took those things out, you fractured the structure, and the picture, while still effective, certainly had nowhere near the impact in its full, in its short version that it did in its long version.
You said they took it out. Who is the they that actually made the editorial decisions?
That's always been a mystery. After tracking it down talking to everybody that had anything to do with it, I never could find out who decided what scenes should be cut. The closest I came was finding a handwritten memo in the old Warner Brothers files from some salesman named Barry Richardson, who suggested that they cut all these beginning expository scenes and these three, actually 2.5 musical numbers. But nobody could ever pinpoint to me. Jack Warner gave the order that it should be cut, but he didn't say what to cut. He just said, shorten it. So the best I can do is say that this fellow named Barry Richardson is the one that decided that these scenes should be taken out.
The first step that you took toward restoring A Star Is Born was to show the movie at a screening, and you made up a brochure, and in the brochure were stills from scenes that were deleted from the film and some of the cut dialogue, excerpts of some of the cut dialogue. This brochure that you put together, it put the word out, basically, that you were doing some detective work on this movie, and that brochure ended up helping you find some of the sound from the film.
Yes, it did. There was a fellow who came to one of the screenings of the museum. We had two screenings of the film. And he introduced himself to me at the time. He was working out at Warner Brothers. He was an apprentice editor. His name was, I remember, David Strohmeyer. He had been so enthused by seeing the film and realizing what was missing that he, on his lunch hour, in his free time, started prowling through the Warner Brothers vaults, and he found the complete 3-hour soundtrack to the film. And so this fact that David had found this complete 3-hour soundtrack convinced me that somewhere out there the footage to the soundtrack was, and it was just a question of somebody going through who knew what to look for until they found it.
This was a long search for you. What were some of the places that you looked that paid off?
There were two places. There was after we did check the and found that the soundtrack did exist, the full-length soundtrack, one of the film editors had taken me to a huge subterranean vault underneath the studio. He had some material from A Star Is Born there. He let me go through it. There were about 25 cans. And I had to go through it on a little rewind, and I was squinting at these scenes, and so far I'd found nothing. And then all of a sudden, there was one can that had what they call separation negatives, which I won't really get into, but it was basically it's a negative they make of the color record, and you can make as many duplicate negatives as you want. But in this particular scene, it's right after the big preview Vicki Lester's film. And she is supposed to, according, it's, they have a love scene on the terrace of a nightclub, and what happens next in the cut film is there's a scene in the producer's office where they tell him they're going to get married. Originally, there was supposed to be a scene on a recording stage where she was singing a song, and he proposes to her, Norman Maine proposes to her. And all of a sudden, I was looking at that scene. It was just astounding. I couldn't believe that here was this 3.5-minute scene all ready, willing, and able to be put back into its place. So that was a major find. That really spurred me on, because for the next several months, I went through just about every single can of film that was in that subterranean vault. I didn't find any more for A Star Is Born, but the next major find was in the what they call the film stock footage library. Anytime a film is finished, all the unused footage is gone through by the editor, and anything that could be used in another movie, long shots of buildings and things like that, is indexed, and they put it in this stock footage library. So I went into the stock footage library, and they had a card file for A Star Is Born, and there were about 400 entries, and there were all the unused takes for the musical numbers, the deleted musical numbers. And there was a great deal of material that had been deleted from the beginning of the film. So we were able to take all of that and use the soundtrack, put it back in where it belonged, and then where we didn't have footage, we would use still photographs of the scenes that were missing.
It must be very thrilling for you to, when you watch A Star Is Born now, feel like, yeah, I helped direct that.
Oh, yes, I'll tell you. Having been a movie freak since I was 10, to know that I had something to do with one of my favorite movies and be able to put it back, and I'm even in it for a brief moment.
Your arm is in it.
My arm is in it. There's a sequence where we didn't have any stills, and we had to rephotograph a sequence that we needed, so somebody had to stand in for Norman Maine, so I just stuck my arm in front of the camera. But it is, I get such a kick out of it. It's hard to explain. I suppose people who make movies will know what I'm talking about. Anybody else, it's almost like, you know, oh, he's off in cloud cuckoo land or something like that. But there's no thrill quite like it.
Well, thank you for restoring it.
Well, thank you for talking about it.
Ronald Haver's book, A Star Is Born, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, I'm Renee Montaigne, co-host of All Things Considered. On today's All Things Considered, we'll have a report on reaction in Gaza to the historic declaration of a Palestinian state. Also, an agreement has been reached in Geneva today between Cuba, Angola, and South Africa over the fate of Cuban troops in Angola. Broadly speaking, the agreement is this: Namibia, which is currently ruled by South Africa, will be given independence in exchange for troops being pulled out of Angola. And a report on a drug-related phenomenon in New York: border babies, children left in hospital nurseries by drug-addicted mothers. A couple of years ago, a call went out for volunteers to come and visit the babies. We visit the babies to see how they're doing. We'll have those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The Dictionary of the Khazars is not a reference book. It's a new novel by the Yugoslavian writer Milorad Pavic, which is based on the story of an ancient people. Book critic John Leonard says this is where a convention ends and a marvelous imaginary journey begins.
Trust me, I know you don't want to hear about another one of those immensely ambitious, wildly experimental, postmodern and post-toasties European novels that will sound in the synopsis more like organic chemistry translated from the Martian than anything anybody normal would want to read. So what if it's written by a Yugoslavian poet you and I never heard of? So what if it appears simultaneously in two separate editions, one male and one female? So what if you can read it backwards, sideways, or upside down? Dictionary of the Khazars is a wonderful book anyway, a wicked combination of Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire, Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye, and the Marx Brothers in A Night at the Opera. There really were Khazars, a tribe of Turkish stock between the Caucasus and the Volga, the Black Sea and the Caspian. From the 7th century to the 10th AD, they got in the way of northern tribes of Bulgars, Magyars, and Vikings that nibbled at Byzantium. They were also, in the south, very hard on Arabs. About 740 AD, the king, his court, and the military caste of these Khazars converted inexplicably to Judaism. 200 years and a Russian invasion later, they had vanished. What little we know of them is passing reference in the 10th century from Arab geographers and Byzantine historians. A tract by Judah Halevi, the Jewish poet-philosopher of Moorish Spain. Various and conflicting reports from Hebrew, Persian, Syrian, and Armenian sources. And meditations on these fragments by modern scholars like Toynbee and Dunlap. More than a decade ago, Arthur Koestler wrote a book, The 13th Tribe, suggesting that the Khazars eventually turned into precisely those Eastern European Jews who suffered the Hitler Holocaust. So much, then, for a chosen people. Milorad Pavic uses all of this as a sort of trampoline from which to bounce into a wild blue yonder of art and anthropology. He imagines a Khazar empire visited in turn by delegates from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. He imagines a Khazar conversion to each of these religions for reasons hinted at in separate notebooks, designated red, green, and yellow, in entries symbolically coded by a cross, a crescent, or a Star of David. He imagines a history of Khazars printed before his own, which was death to read, and a priestly sect of dream hunters who project themselves into the past and future, trying to reassemble the broken body of the original Adam in the original garden, the oldest of testaments. And a conspiracy of modern scholars who murder one another, either to possess or to suppress the Khazar secret. And he does all this in the form of a dictionary, any item of which can be read and understood independently of any other item before or after it. He is, of course, making fun of organized religion and its clerics, of deconstruction as theory and practice in literary criticism, of a Serbian identity crisis in present-day Yugoslavia, and of himself, a glorious rubbish heap of all these systems and ideas. But he's also letting us dream our way through history into magic and marvels, back beyond politics and theology to the oldest stories of love and death and the blessings of infinite possibility. He plays with the braids of our being.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Dictionary of the Khazars by Milorad Pavic. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I'll speak with comic Jonathan Winters, a master of improvisation and characterization who says his loneliness as an only child led him to create some of his more enduring characters. Pianist Arthur Schnabel is best known for his interpretations of Beethoven and Schubert, but our classical music critic Lord Schwartz thinks Schnabel is the greatest Mozart pianist he's ever heard. Next time, Lord reviews four new compact discs featuring Schnabel playing Mozart. And urban legends expert Jan Harald Brunvand shares several versions of one of the most popular legends now making the rounds, one he calls the hairdryer, and that's hair as in rabbit. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.